Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. Fred Granny filling in for Frank Gaffney today. Much to talk about in the defense of the free world, and somebody we always like to talk to on this program, Virginia Congressman Frank Wolf, who, among other things, has just come back from Sudan. If you don't know, Frank Wolf has been a member of Congress since 1980. He is the dean of the Virginia delegation. He is a champion of human rights around the world and has written a book called Prisoner of Conscience, which we recommend and we've talked about on this show. But Congressman, thanks for being with us. The first thing I wanted to get into was this trip that you just took to Sudan, because that is a part of the world that I think we still know very little about. You've been there six times, and most recently you were, I guess, up in the Nuba Mountains in South Sudan. Tell us what you saw there.
Fred, thanks for having me on the show. Sudan has been the center point, the beginning of all the terrorism that we're faced with in the world. There's actually a classic book out about it written by a former Professor Collins, who since died. If you recall, bin Laden lived in Sudan from 91 to 94, and al-Turabi invited and Bashir invited them in, Hamas, Hezbollah, training camps. So all of this activity that we're now dealing with actually came out of Khartoum back in the late 70s and the early 80s. We were up in the town of a little refugee camp called Yida, which is just about an hour south of the north-south border. There are about 25,000 people in the camps, mainly from the Nuba Mountains. In interviewing the people, the three things came up. They felt, one, the Antonov, this is a Russian-made bomber that flies over and bombing people sometimes four times a day, has just terrorized the people. I mean, it has just terrorized them. It's been fearful. And every woman we interviewed mentioned Antonov. Secondly, every woman we interviewed mentioned race. They felt they were being targeted because they're black Africans. And of course, this is the same thing that we heard in Darfur. And the Khartoum government is very much against them. That's just the reality of it. And in the Nuba Mountains, they're starving. Many are living in caves. Ann Curry from NBC News and Nicholas Kristof were up there 2 days before we were there. And to their credit, I mean, they really did an incredible job of telling what was going on. But these people are facing famine, disease, so many problems. And in addition to that, the Antonov flies over. And it's all done by Bashir, who is an indicted war criminal. And if you saw the news yesterday, the Khartoum defense minister was just indicted by the International Criminal Court. So these are basically war criminals.
You know, you raise an interesting point, though, about that part of the world, because when we think of seedbeds of terrorism, obviously we think of places like Tehran and perhaps Syria, but Khartoum usually doesn't make the list for most people. And yet, based on what you've told me, and the center, for example, has sent a guy over there, a guy named Amin Ismail, who is in the Nuba Mountains himself, and he said for years, Khartoum is essentially the epicenter of terrorist training for that part of the world.
It is. In fact, the next time you come up to my office, if you let me know, I will bring Dr. Collins' book in. He used to come by the office. He since died. He lived in Sudan for years and taught at the University of California in Santa Barbara. But he makes a very powerful case and is really a scholar. But that's where it all began. That literally, and what we're facing now all over is really has come out of basically Khartoum. And the same guy is in office now, Bashir, who was there when they had bin Laden come in.
But let me ask you this, because you chair the Foreign Operations Appropriations Subcommittee, which funds, supposedly at least participates in UN missions to provide relief for South Sudan. Has that aid been ineffective? I mean, how do we address this through the UN, or is the UN pretty much useless now in terms of solving this problem?
Well, I don't know that I'd say they're useless, but they haven't been effective, Fred. In fact, is they're periodically in the camp that we were in, but they don't stay in the camp for fear and different reasons. Secondly, there have been a number of reports that up in the Nuba Mountains, up in a place called Kidigli, the UN forces, UN peacekeepers, were literally turning Africans over to the Sudanese military, where they were slitting their throat and killing them and shooting them. And thirdly, the George Clooney satellite program has pictures of what they call mass graves. And some of those people were turned over. Literally, the UN peacekeeper was there and got out of the way and turned the people over.
I got to tell you, that sounds like Rwanda.
Fred, it is Rwanda. Now, the difference here is nobody's there. If a tree falls in the forest and nobody's there to hear it and nobody's there to see it, then it never fell in the forest. And that's what's taking place. That's why I appreciate Ann Curry and Christoph Klein. But the media is not getting in. I did see that. I create a cistern that's going to go up there in a couple of weeks. But it's a very – what's taking place there, Fred, if Christiane Amanpour and the West were covering like they did in Bosnia, the world would know about it. But no one's there.
All right.
No one's there.
Well, let me turn to something else that you did this week. You offered an interesting proposal on the floor a day or so ago when you said, why don't we create – actually, you've already funded. Why don't we impanel a – Afghanistan-Pakistan study group, modeled along the Iraq study group, five Democrats, five Republicans. And you said this, an independent panel of five Democrats and five Republicans who love their country more than their party. I stopped right there, Frank, because are there still 10 guys who love their party, love their country more than their party?
Well, yeah, you know, I think so, Fred. I mean, we had a success on the Iraq study group. We were going through the same environment. Yet the Iraq war was only going on for 3.5 years.
Yeah, right.
And we were able to get Baker, Jim Baker, former Secretary of State, and Lee Hamilton, former chairman, as you know, of the Intel Committee and co-chairman of 9/11. They were all patriots, and they were all out of the political process in the sense that they weren't running for office and doing those things. And Leon Panetta served on the panel, and also former Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense Gates.
Well, what's his reaction? What's Panetta's reaction to this panel? Because he's in a position, well, perhaps, to endorse it.
Well, it's painful, but I can't even get Leon Panetta to return my telephone calls. I've sent seven letters. If you look at yesterday's record, I put all the letters in. I can't even get him to answer one of the seven letters. And interesting enough, Fred, when we first put this idea out, one of the strongest supporters who actually encouraged me to do it was Ryan Crocker, who's our ambassador now in Afghanistan. He felt we had to do it. Well, but no one's – the media, Fred, has not focusing on this. They've gone asleep on it. And yesterday we lost two more servicemen. We lost a total of six. And someone – has to speak out. Roughly 10% or more of the deaths in Afghanistan lately have come from what they call green on blue, whereby right. Afghan military are killing our own people.
Well, do you think that the administration has essentially thrown in the towel on Afghanistan and we are just kind of playing a grisly waiting game? Because based on the aftermath of the Quran burning and the never-ending apologies and absolutely no protection for American or even NATO forces, do you think a panel like this could really get much done in the time that remains?
Well, I think they could. In fact, this would not be a long, drawn-out year thing. I think you'd bring them together. It's almost a gift for the administration, too. I mean, they would bring them together in 30 to 60 days. They would go out there. They would, and I want us to be successful. I've had high-level people in the CIA, former CIA, approach me to tell me that they thought they could do teams in and teams out, drones in and drones out when they reconstitute. I mean, there are ways to do this without putting a men and women at exposure, Fred. In Iraq, our embassy now is pretty much tied down to the embassy.
Mm-hmm.
They can't even move around the country. We're getting to that point now in Kabul. The first time I went there, I, with Tony Hall and Joe Pitts, we were the first guys to go there when the war broke out. We were able to rock around the country without any escorts. In fact, the military wouldn't talk to us. Second time we went there, I watched the elections. Now you couldn't go there and move around the country. So it is in trouble. And what we want to do is to create this Afghanistan-Pakistan study group. And I would hope the media, I appreciate you've been asking about it. We've had no response from the media. You get guys like Joe Scarborough and all these people, they pontificate and talk about it, and then they never cover the story. There is $1 million waiting for Leon Panetta to select. He gets to select the team, select the venue, select the people and everything, and he won't do it.
Well, whatever we can do at the center to kind of carry your water for you here, Congressman, we will do. I hope we haven't run out of time in Afghanistan. It does seem to me the administration is kind of waiting out the clock. But it's always great to talk to you, Frank. Thanks for being with us on Secure Freedom Radio.
Okay, thank you, Fred.
We'll be right back.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
My name is Sunday Hollis, and I totally lost the cravings for sweets. I totally lost the cravings for bread, even meat. And some people, you know, you would see people say, oh, well, you're eating a salad because you're trying to diet, but you just don't have a taste for any other junk anymore. And it is so, so, so true. I'm thinking this is something that the celebrities are using. They're just not giving the meta system the credit for it. I've tried everything under the sun, and this is the only product that I have even called the company and asked them, could I sell it for them? This is a product where you can actually use the word awesome. I mean, and it is the whole essence of the word awesome.
Don't wait another minute to start losing weight. Call Judy Singer's The Meta System at 1-800-711-JUDY. That's 1-800-711-JUDY.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
We could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Fred Grandy with you today, filling in for Frank Gaffney. And we talk, as we normally do on this program, about wars in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, Syria, Iran. What about the war in our own backyard? Listen to this. Nearly 40,000 people have already lost their lives in the drug wars south of the border, and now the Mexican cartels are moving their operations north into the United States. That is from a new book called Cartel, The Coming Invasion of Mexico's Drug Wars. The author is Sylvia Longmire. She is a former senior intelligence analyst for the state of California, former special agents for the United States Air Force, and currently an independent consultant and expert witness on asylum cases. You may have seen her on CNN, MSNBC, or Fox, but if not, you can listen to her right now because she joins us. Sylvia, thanks for being with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I found this book, well, let me put it this way. I found it troubling, particularly when I got to your conclusion, where you said, and I think I'm stating this correctly, the Mexican drug war cannot be won. It is a conflict that can only be managed. Is that a way of conceding defeat in this war that not enough of us know anything about?
Well, I get asked that question a lot. You know, is President Calderon, is he winning? Is the Mexican government losing? Is this something that can be won? But folks have to understand that this isn't like the Civil War where you have two clear-cut sides or there's a clear goal and a clear way of winning. It's not World War II. You're not fighting the Nazis, and when the Germans are defeated, all of a sudden you have freedom. You have separate entities, organized criminal groups that are very shady and kind of nebulous. And who is going to concede? There's nobody really to raise the white flag. And at what point would you say that you've won? You're never going to get rid of all drug trafficking. You're never going to get rid of all violence associated with the drug trade. So there are no clear-cut answers. It's something that can only be managed, meaning bringing violence down to a manageable level like we have here in the United States. You know, we have crime in big cities, sometimes in small towns, but we can go about our daily lives and without fear of getting shot on our way to the supermarket or taking our kids to school and finding beheaded corpses in front of our kids' elementary school.
Well,
that's what I mean.
Let me talk about Mexico then right now, because as you lay it out in this book, it's hard to really consider Mexico a country as much as it is a cartel. Obviously, the Sinaloa Federation, Los Zetas, others vying for power. But it seems as though we're almost looking at a feudal regime with these large criminal entities vying for political power as well as economic power.
Well, I wouldn't say so much that they're vying for political power, because then you start talking about insurgency, and it's definitely not that clear cut. Now, the cartels definitely want to manipulate politics at a certain level, particularly at the local level and to some extent the state level. They want to make sure that there are mayors and police chiefs in office who will cooperate with them, or at the very least look the other way and allow them to operate freely and independently so they can continue to maximize their profits. There's some evidence, for instance, in the state of Michoacán, where one of the cartels has been accused of interfering directly in the elections and rigging the elections, but they actually really don't care even who's president. You know, at that level, it doesn't really matter to them because they don't want to take over the government. They just want to be able to operate freely and in many cases have the cooperation of the government so they can continue their illegal business.
And as you point out, in areas like Michoacán and Juarez, citizens don't know who to turn to because frequently law enforcement is in the pocket of these large cartels. A couple of very tragic examples, human examples, you cite in the book.
Yes, and people will not call the police, especially for kidnappings, because it's very often the police themselves who are involved in the actual kidnappings or extortion rackets. And then you have, like, La Familia is a really kind of strange, it's a real oddity because they're more like a cult. They have a religious foundation in how they were formed, so they actually provide services to the people of Michoacán, even banking. So in many cases, the people will turn to the cartel because they're considered more reliable as far as providing them protection or providing them with certain services than the state or local government or the local police.
Let me ask you this. In your research, have you found much of a presence of Hezbollah in the middle of this ongoing drug war and struggle for power among the cartels?
No. I mean, Hezbollah is in Mexico, and we know that they've come into the United States that way, but not to the extent that people believe or sometimes they hear and get alarmed. We have to realize there are thousands of members of Hezbollah already in the United States. A lot of people don't know that, and I've written about that for Homeland Security Today magazine. And they're here to raise money. They're selling fake purses in New York City. They're selling fake cigarettes in the northern tier and the eastern seaboard. So they're already here. The difference is between Hezbollah coming here, whether it's from Mexico or whether it's directly on airplanes, coming here to blow things up and make money and send it back. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's no acceptable level of members of Hezbollah who are here in the United States at all. But there's a lot of hubbub that comes from, we have members of Hezbollah coming across the southwest border and terrorists are using the southwest border. Well, we have to back up a little bit. We know that people who are somehow affiliated or associated with certain terrorist groups have come through Mexico using special human smugglers who specialize in bringing Middle Easterners and other other folks who are not Mexicans across the border. But there is zero evidence that any members of Hezbollah or any other group like Hamas or Al-Qaeda have come here under an operational capacity, meaning coming here with the intention to blow something up. And that's a very significant distinction that that folks need to understand.
Well, then let me turn to another aspect of the book that I found terribly troubling, and that is the level of sophistication of these cartels. Principally, and I put this in the context of Republican candidates running for president right now, all talking about a fence. But you talk about a level of penetration that actually involves tunnels and submarines where drugs are delivered. I mean, I don't cover this as closely as you do, but I thought I understood something about this. I never would have believed drug cartels were in the submarine business.
Oh, yeah, over, under, and around. You know, when people talk about fencing the entire border, I just laugh. I'm like, yeah, that'll maybe slow them down, but it's not going to stop them. Yeah, as far as the submarines, there's a wide variety of levels of sophistication, and some of the cartels will contract out. There was one particular submarine. It was multi-million-dollar affair. They contracted some Russian engineers working out of Colombia to put this thing together, and it looked like one of the submarines out of the 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea ride.
Like the Nautilus, right?
And, yeah, and it can carry up to like 6 tons of dope. I mean, these things are absolutely crazy. But then you have smaller ones that look like they're put together with, you know, some cardboard and PVC and held together with a few rolls of duct tape. So it really just all depends on who's putting it together. But they get the job done as far as hauling huge loads of drugs up the coast, up the Pacific coast from South America to Mexico. Then you have ultralight aircraft that the cartels are using to fly up to 250 to 300 pounds of dope across the border below the radar. They're extremely difficult to detect, and now they're getting much better at not even having to land and dropping the bales of marijuana from the aircraft and turning around and flying back into Mexico. And actually, we know that they're doing this. Actually, National Geographic's channel's Border Wars, their crew was out in Arizona in the middle of the night one night and happened to accidentally catch one of these flights on infrared coming across the border and dropping the bales. So now, they're getting much better at this.
Just so that I'm clear on this, these are manned aircraft. They're not drones, are they?
That's right. That's right. It just takes one guy a little bit of training. They take off from airstrips on the Mexican side of the border. They come into Arizona and Texas where they have folks that are staged there waiting for them with either an ATV or a pickup truck. Sometimes those folks are Mexican. Sometimes they're American and Caucasian, and they're just, you know, into to make some money. And as soon as the dope is dropped on the American side, they're taken to the next location by the folks who are waiting for them. And the person flying the ultralight will either take off or just turn around and head back into Mexico and do it all over again a few days later.
Okay, so we're talking about digging post holes and putting up chicken wire, and they're beating us on air, land, and sea. And under the ground.
Yeah, pretty much.
Well,
yeah.
In the time we have left, we have a little less than a minute. Are there some solutions that you can leave with us to at least begin to get a grip on this problem? If only to understand it.
Well, we need to take them more seriously, first of all. You know, we're treating them like criminals and
yes.
thugs and punks, and it's not, you know, I've watched all the GOP debates. I've watched, you know, some of the different issues that have been brought up in the campaign and stuff this year, and I just feel like border security is not a priority. You know, they talk about border security for like 20 seconds and then move on to immigration, but you look at all the reporting, all the rhetoric that's out there, and I just don't think it's a top priority. And we need to be smart about how we allocate our money and our people. You can't just throw money and throw people at the border. You have to figure out where are the biggest threats coming from. Let's hit, you know, preventing actual operational terrorists from coming across first. Then we hit the dangerous drug smugglers who are bringing guns and violence across the border. And then we take a look at illegal immigration and how we can manage that. So it's all about priorities and about being smart.
All right. Well, Sylvia, thanks very much. The book is called Cartel, The Coming Invasion of Mexico's Drug Wars. The author is Sylvia Longmire. Sylvia, thanks for being with us, and we'll be right back after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, NBA forward Kevin Durant from the Oklahoma City Thunder. Here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
And that's a slam dunk.
Whether you like to shoot hoops like me, skateboard, ride a bike,
or dance on your roof, just move it your way.
For an hour a day. Because moving every day puts you on the offense towards a stronger you.
And and that makes you part of a winning team.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Bugs.
So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up, play, and move it your way. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
You said it at www.letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira, and like a well, you can be a source of hope in life. www.waterforcongo.com.
In 1966 in Anchorage, Alaska, a talented child was born. He would go on to be one out of only 11 Alaskans to make it to the major leagues. The odds of him striking out more than 3,000 hitters? 1 in 33 million. The odds of this pitcher being selected to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game 6 times? 1 in 48 million. The odds of this fast-balling philanthropist winning the World Series 3 times? 1 in 3 million. The odds of this man having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Hi, I'm Kurt Schilling. Learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Autism is getting closer to home. From 1 in 5,000 only 20 years ago, today 1 in 110 children are diagnosed. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
What are you doing?
Filling out a loan application.
I can help you get approved, you know.
Really? How?
With this.
A bag of sand?
It's not a bag. It's a pouch. And it's not sand. It's credit fairy dust.
Credit fairy dust?
Yes. I sprinkle some fairy dust on the application, and your credit rating magically improves.
There's no such thing as the credit fairy.
An unbeliever now. But what will you think when your loan is approved?
I'll think my credit score improved because I paid my bills on time, kept my credit card balances low, and only opened a new card if I really needed it.
It's the dust.
It's sand.
Don't deny the credit fairy.
There's no magic to improving your credit, but there is help, and it's free. Go to creditfairy.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the Consumer Bankers Foundation, the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights Education Fund, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Fred Grandy in for Frank Gaffney. Want to welcome an old friend of this show, an old friend of mine, Deborah Burlingame, probably somebody you know if you've paid any attention to the media since 9/11. She has been a prominent spokesperson since that time. She is the co-founder of 9/11 Families for a Safe and Strong America, co-founded Keep America Safe with Liz Cheney and Bill Kristol, keep us apprised of national security issues, particularly the trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, which will not take place in New York. Thanks largely to her. Been a virulent opponent of the Ground Zero Mosque, writes regularly about domestic terrorism in the Wall Street Journal, and let me just say, if you're looking for a soft-spoken interview, this is not the place to come when Deborah Burlingame is on the show. Thank you for being here.
Great to be with you, Fred, as always.
I wanted to talk about something specifically coming up in New York this Monday. We saw one another this week when we were both up in New York at an event for Roger Ailes, and Police Commissioner Ray Kelly is under some fire for an ongoing investigation of Muslim student associations, as well as his association with Zudi Jasser in a movie called The Third Jihad Now, apparently, there is a rally in his behalf. Could you tell us a little bit about what this is and why Commissioner Kelly needs this support?
Well, first of all, it isn't just for Commissioner Kelly, because the entire NYPD is under attack. The Associated Press really launched a witch hunt back in November, accusing the NYPD and under Ray Kelly's leadership of engaging in spying on Muslims, inflammatory charges that were picked up by their cohorts at the New York Times. And now you have so-called Muslim civil rights groups, such as led by CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, which is really a front group for Hamas, one of the unindicted co-conspirators in the largest terrorism finance trials in the United States. They have got out there calling for Ray Kelly's dismissal, being fired, and for this practice of going into mosques or showing up in public places to stop. And we are supporting a group that is having a press conference on Monday at 10 o'clock at One Police Plaza. And this is very important because this group is more than 20 prominent Muslim leaders and heads of Muslim organizations that are the Muslims that you and I want to embrace. These are people who believe in religious pluralism. They support the Constitution. They are American patriots. They have religious freedom and freedom of conscience. And they adamantly reject organizations like CARE who purport to represent Muslims, which they do not.
Let me ask you something about that. Because before we go any further, I want to find out your take. I have always assumed that it's these Muslims, Zuhdi Jasser and people who are involved in the American Islamic Leadership Coalition, the American Islamic Forum on Democracy, who are constituting the majority of Muslim Americans, people who are patriots, people who are citizens, people who practice their faith in a way that does not run counter to the Constitution or American values. Is that your take on this as well?
Well, yes, it is. And in fact, these are secularists. In other words, these are people who believe in the separation of mosque and state, or as it's stated in our Constitution, church and state. They believe that they reject the concept of political Islam and Sharia, okay? So that's who these people are. And with respect to how representative they are of American Muslims, I think it's fair to say that they are representative. I never understood, Fred, in the years following 9/11, why we didn't hear more from these people. And there's a couple of reasons for that. Number one, the Muslim community, the larger Muslim community out there in the world, 1.4 to 1.6 billion Muslims, really belong to that body of Islam that does embrace Sharia. The American Muslims, for the most part, do reject it. They come here and they have fled the clutches of Sharia. But that is a rather controversial thing in the Muslim world. And so when they stick their heads up and announce that, they become targets in their own community, in a large community. And organizations like CARE goes to great lengths to intimidate them. And so they have finally now, 10 years after 9/11, Zuhdi Jasser has been out there on the vanguard for years, kind of a lone voice. But now this is a group that has come together and said, enough is enough. You are now, CARE, AP, the establishment media, going after the very police force that is charged with protecting our communities. And we want them to continue to do that, and we have to speak up. And, you know, Zuhdi has been out there saying, Dr. Jasser has been out there saying, that this is a conversation that Muslims must have publicly. And they're very courageous for doing this because they're going to be attacked. There will be an attempt to marginalize them. But I can tell you, Fred, I have talked with Muslims, and I will always ask them, if they permit me, are you a secular Muslim? And I've had Muslims literally look around to see who can hear them, and they say, yes.
I've run into that too.
It's like a form of McCarthyism, you know, where there's fear and intimidation from the recent immigrants that come here, or the ones that are not here as residents but are here to transport Sharia into the United and embed it in the United States.
A concerted effort by prominent organizations. You mentioned one, CARE, but the Islamic Society of North America, Muslim Public Affairs Council, are essentially so embedded within the media and in some cases even government and, of course, academia, that they presume to speak for this community. And that's why this particular rally is terribly important, and you make a good point. It's not just for Ray Kelly, of course. The NYPD needs this support, but it's for all of those voices out there that never get a chance to be heard. You know what it reminds reminds me of? It reminds me of Horton Hears a Who, Deborah. You know, remember the people in Whoville say, we are here, we are here, we are here. Well, that seems to be what you and Zudi Jasser are trying to do.
Yes, and I think, you know, those of us who lost loved ones on 9/11, you know, I lived in New York City before 9/11 for almost 30 years. I never gave the issue of Muslims, you know, any more thought than I would give any other particular religion. New York is a very diverse and pluralistic place. But when we've taken up these issues, we've been called Islamophobes and Muslim haters and so forth. And it simply isn't true. And so this is an opportunity for us to come out and say to American Muslims, we're with you. If you stand with these groups, let your voices be heard. We're there to back you up. We're there to embrace you and stand with you and help you enjoy the freedoms that this country is offering like everybody else. We want to support you very, very much. And it's for them and it's for us. It's for all of us. So the 9/11 families, first responders, and 9/11 community is going to this press conference at 10 o'clock on Monday at One Police Plaza. We're there in a supporting role to the world that we are standing with these people.
And I just wanted to reiterate, obviously, Ray Kelly has some support from the mayor. I think Senator Schumer is on board with this. I know Congressman Pete King, whom we saw this week. But I can't help noticing that the Justice Department is looking seriously into investigating the NYPD now, or at least that seems to be coming from Eric Holder. And no less a person than the governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie, has gone out of his way to criticize Ray Kelly as well. It seems to me that New Jersey's best friend is the NYPD, based on the kind of terrorists we know have been in Paterson and elsewhere in northern New Jersey.
Right. Well, we know that the 1993 plot the World Trade Center bombing, in which six people, including a woman who was 7 months pregnant, were killed. That was a devastating bombing. That was all hatched from New Jersey. And we know that the 9/11 conspirators went into libraries in New Jersey and got their tickets. They went online and got their tickets. They met in New Jersey. And we lost 726 people who worked in the World Trade Center lived in New Jersey. So I think one of the lessons of the 1993 investigation is that you don't screech to a halt at the border at the Hudson River and say there we're done, folks, and walk away. That was one of the lessons of the 93 bombing. And you're right, Mayor Bloomberg is vigorously supporting Ray Kelly and this practice. And he was just last week cited the Hanshu decision as the legal basis for doing this. They're not breaking any laws. They're allowed to go into public places and follow leads. And to say that they aren't is to suggest that, you know, when you get wind of a plot, you can't walk into a public place that you and I can walk into. You can't log on to a website that the public can log on to hunt down these leads. And you know what, Fred? We know that the public supports this. And we also know that this is about demonizing. This is about intimidating on the part of groups like CARE, these Hamas front groups, the Sharia embracing group. And as for Chris Christie, you know, this is a guy who's, you know, got a political agenda, which, you know, one can support when it comes to his fiscal policy. But he's made a lot of enemies there in New Jersey. And this is one of the things he can do, paying lip service that, you know, he's not always towing the line to the common causes on the other side of the river. I think Chris Christie needs to get a clue and educate himself. He should spend some time with you, Fred, to educate himself on what these practices are, and that the fact that they are legal, they don't trounce on anyone's right. And Muslims, by the way, in New Jersey, don't want to be the targets of terrorism any more than anyone else.
Well, at the very least, we have to wrap this up, but at the very least, Governor Christie should pay very close attention to this press conference, which will be at 10 o'clock Monday morning, this coming Monday, at One Police Plaza. Zudi Jasser, American Islamic Leadership Coalition, Deborah Burlingame, other leaders will be there. I hope you will be too. Deborah, thanks for being with us on Secure Freedom Radio.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Energy efficiency interviews are brought to you by the U.S. Department of Energy and the Ad Council.
April.
Yeah?
So you know your charger that's plugged into the wall? It's still using energy, even though it's not attached to a phone.
That's not my charger. I don't even have a cell phone.
You know what? I'll just unplug it. I'm busy. I'll call you back.
Millions of kids are using their energy wisely. What's your excuse? Learn more at loseyourexcuse.gov.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
In Washington, Hugh Hewitt has the diagnosis.
They don't understand the need for speed.
Oh, we'll get to it. Don't worry. We'll get it done. Open amendment process, blah, 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 blah.
Not in the least bit clued in to the sense of urgency, but I don't think the Beltway is.
I'm just beginning to think it is a Beltway disease.
Kind of an invisible wall separates them from what the people think.
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org. Even if it's just everyday stuff, like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. And because it's Friday, we always end the show with a conversation with Bill Gertz. He writes the Inside the Ring column for the Washington Times and is currently the editor for the Washington Free Beacon. Bill, thanks for being with us.
Sure. Good to be on the show.
I want to get your take. I know you've been following this whole TRICARE controversy and the president's attempts to raise health care costs. What's your evaluation of why the president is doing this?
It's clear that this is a story that I broke in the Washington Free Beacon, which mm-hmm. I'm now the senior editor of. This is a very important story because it's set off a firestorm of controversy both on Capitol Hill and within the military retiree community. Basically, what's happened is in the current defense budget, the Pentagon is looking to save $1.9 billion this year and $13 billion over the next 5 years. And at the same time, the more or less unionized civilian government workforce is being not having the same kind of cuts. As Buck McKeon, the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, stated, he said, this is another Obama administration hit on the military. In other words, here the military is being asked to cut $487 billion. They don't have enough forces. They're not going to have enough equipment. And on top of that, they're raising fees for pharmaceuticals on active duty military and sharply increasing premiums for retirees under the healthcare system known as TRICARE.
Doesn't this put Secretary Panetta in kind of a rock, between a rock and a hard place? Because obviously he's got to defend the cuts because he's Obama's soldier. But I can't believe the chairmen of the Joint Chiefs, the heads of the military, the uniform guys, are on board with this. But obviously the unions are, the civilian unions.
Well, I haven't seen it, but I've been told by officials that all of the Joint Chiefs and the chairmen have signed a letter endorsing these cuts, and this is angering a lot of the rank and file military people. General Dempsey, the chairman, issued a statement where he realized that this is a problem, and he issued a statement February 21st where he said, we've heard your concerns about the health care increases. I have to point out that Congress has to approve these increases. This is not something the Pentagon can do because Congress in the last year's defense bill capped any increases that would be pegged to basically any cost of living, so it would be a neutral factor. But this is going to be a big fight, and it's not over yet. And obviously, I think when the dust settles on it, I think Congress is going to win and the administration won't be, because the reaction I've been getting from both current and former military people is just total outrage. People signed up to do their service, and they were promised free health care, and now the government is going back on it because of disproportionate cuts in defense spending.
And you believe that the Armed Services Committee Chairman McKeon will probably move to reinstate these cuts in this particular fiscal year?
Well, they have to approve them, like I say, because they're capped already. Yeah, I believe that's how it's going to ultimately change, but we'll have to see.
And what about sequestration, Bill? Would this be something that would go forward into the 10-year plan as well, assuming it passed in this particular budget year?
Well, the Pentagon basically is ignoring the automatic additional up to $600 billion cuts,
yes, right,
over 10 years that will be required under sequestration. So they haven't even looked at that. So that's like a whole different set of problems that will be created if that actually goes into effect. And there's some legislation circulating on the Hill that's designed to try and prevent defense. You know, it was McKeon who was just the other day, and I had this in my story, he said, the defense budget is about 20% of the overall federal budget, but yet the cuts that are being imposed on defense represent 50% of the budget. So defense, it's clear that the administration is targeting defense for these cuts. And there are real concerns, especially with this health care issue, that this will affect recruitment. We have an all-volunteer force,
sure,
and those benefits are crucial to that, as well as retention. People are just going to say, look, with this and the other things, social engineering that the administration has been doing, a lot of people will just pull the ripcord and say they're out.
Well, let's talk about another aspect in your Inside the Ring column, talking about pulling the ripcord. Which way do we pull the ripcord in Syria right now? There seems to be what you call a quandary within the administration as to just how much or how little the administration should get involved in supporting, I assume, what we're calling the resistance in Syria. But that resistance, if I'm reading the tea leaves right, looks like it's lining up with the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda, whereas on the other side, you've got Iran, the Syrian government, and probably Hezbollah. That doesn't seem like much of a choice.
Very difficult choice. There's atrocities being committed by the Syrian government against civilians. There are mounting calls for some type of intervention. The question then is, who are you intervening to help?
Mm-hmm.
And it's clear that, you know, that the Islamists are on the rise in the Middle East, that this is not a democratic revolution that's sweeping the Arab world. It's an Islamist revolution. And so this administration has clearly aligned with the Islamists in a lot of places. And at the same time, they're also concerned about the humanitarian crisis that's taking place in Syria. That said, there are voices in Saudi Arabia, the Saudi King Abdullah and the foreign minister, Saud al-Faisal, spoke recently that there should be intervention in the form of covert military aid to the resistance or even military intervention, foreign forces going in there. So it's not clear where this is headed.
Is it conceivable that we would stay out of this fight, that we would say, let the Saudis, let the Gulf states weigh in as they see fit? Obviously, there's no shortage of cash there if they want to invest in arms and some kind of support for the rebels. But is there an upside to the U.S. becoming involved, even as an investor, on one side or the other here?
It's not clear to me because you have tensions rising over Iran. You know, there could be a trigger there if the Iranians try to close the Strait of Hormuz. We've got conflicts going, winding down in Iraq and Afghanistan. I don't think the military right now, from a defense and defense policy community, has any stomach for engaging in any kind of an intervention.
Then let's, in the last couple of minutes that we have, turn to another item in your Inside the Ring column that struck me as odd. You're reporting on the State Department denying $2 million in grants to a Russian research institute because they're concerned the money could be used to boost Moscow's advanced nuclear missile work. Now, my question, Bill, is why are we giving them grants in the first place? What did we think we were buying before we were otherwise prized?
Yeah, this is a big problem. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, we've had something known as the Nunn-Lugar program.
Sure, I know.
And this is a program to try and prevent the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction expertise, that is, people and technology, from leaving the former Soviet Union and going to rogue states. The program is not being monitored well, in my view. I don't think Congress has really put a close magnifying glass on this. And this is one case that surfaced in the Russian press of the $2 million grant to a Russian institute that was doing something called plasma actuator work. It's a high technology term for controlling the flight of a high speed projectile or unmanned aerial vehicle. And this is the Russians' counter to U.S. missile defenses. It's something called the depressed trajectory warhead. And at the last minute, it seems that they blocked it. The question I have is, how many other grants and millions of dollars have been going to fund Russian weapons buildup?
And particularly now that Vladimir Putin is poised to become the new leader for who knows how long, and apparently is not even subtle in his contempt for the United States. He obviously got the better of us in the START agreement and is openly criticizing the United States. I just don't understand why the State Department or any function of the United States government would be pouring money into Russia right now.
It's like I said, the government, they get on autopilot on these programs. And it's a misguided do-gooder sense of trying to help things. And, you know, the Russians a long time ago have turned south. I think the invasion of Georgia was a clear example that we needed to review all of those programs.
Oh, Bill, that's great. We'll have to leave it there. This is Bill Gertz, Inside the Ring. That's it for Secure Freedom Radio. Frank will be back on Monday. This is Fred Grandy. Stay safe.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.